and voices at Greenbelt. And with no further ado, I shall ask him to come and speak. It's my pleasure to welcome, please, Paul Valeri.
Sorry? I think I might speak louder than my introducer anyway. So is that, how's that, folks? Can you hear at the back? Thumbs up at the back? Yes, there we are. Thank you. Just 10 days after he'd been elected Pope, Pope Francis went to Castel Gandolfo, which is the summer residence of the Popes, traditionally the summer residence. He's never been there. He thinks poor people can't go on holiday, so he shouldn't. But Pope Benedict was there. It was where he was living, and while they were getting the monastery ready inside the Vatican, where he went to live eventually. And when he arrived, Benedict was out on the lawn to greet him, and it was quite chill, and he had a white quilted jacket on over his white cassock. The media were there in huge numbers. This was a very historic encounter. First time in 500 years that there had been two popes, and the old pope was meeting the new pope. And the media noted how Benedict acknowledged Francis to be the pope with a small gesture. He offered him the right-hand side of the car, the traditional place of the pope, and he took the left. And Francis reciprocated by treating his predecessor as an equal by refusing the solo papal kneeler at the front of the chapel and kneeling side by side in the front row with Benedict, saying, "No, we are brothers." That's what the media wrote about. What they didn't write about was that the two men then went into the library in Castel Gandolfo, and as they sat there and had their official photographs taken, anybody who was astute would have noticed there was a large white box on this low table between them. And on top of the box was a large envelope. Inside the box was a report that had been compiled by three cardinals at Benedict's request, after their investigation into what's called the VatiLeaks affair. It was reported in a fairly jaunty way because the Pope's butler had been leaking documents to the press, and it was kind of, oh, what the butler leaked. But actually, it was very serious because what the butler leaked revealed, and it came out when the butler went on trial, at the highest levels of the Catholic Church, there was intrigue and infighting and ambition and arrogance and careerism and corruption. And this big box contained all the witness statements of the people who'd been quizzed by the three cardinals, and the envelope contained their conclusions. And the contents were so explosive that they had proved the final straw for Pope Benedict, who resigned. He was frail anyway, but he resigned within a few weeks of reading this. Now, in the election for a new pope, it's preceded by conversations in which all the cardinals can take place. And in these conversations, these congregations, as they're called, cardinal after cardinal referred to the contents of this box. But only the three who'd compiled it knew what was in it. Only those three and Benedict knew. But the people knew that there was, within the church's central organization, the bureaucracy, which is called the Roman Curia, the word that kept being used was dysfunctional. And it was in need of a radical shake-up, and they elected Francis, Jorge Mario Bergoglio as he was, because they thought he was the man to do that. Now, for the past 2 years, Pope Francis has enchanted and bewildered the world in equal measure with his compassion and his contradictions. And as his papacy enters its third year, the old debate about is Francis a liberal or a conservative seems now to be irrelevant, because what's emerged is a pope who's orthodox on doctrine but revolutionary in his application of it. And let me give you some examples. He puts the gospel and a vividly merciful expression of the gospel before dogma. He's got an openness to liturgy, another issue which polarizes so many people within the church. And he has about him a simplicity which is calculated. and a humility which is audacious, and an asceticism which is joyful rather than puritanical. We all know he rejected the papal palace in favour of living in the Vatican guest house, the Casa Santa Marta, not only out of a distaste for luxury, but because he needs to chat to other people in the cafeteria rather than living in regal isolation. We know he's endorsed traditional Catholic teachings, but he's given new reasons for them or added new dimensions to them. So take the example of the Catholic ban on artificial contraception. He's reiterated that, but he didn't do it by referring to philosophy, theology, theories of natural law, as previous popes had. He sees that as a defence of poor people the face of an assault by rich people who want to impose population control as a way of grabbing an even greedier share of the world's resources. So he ends up in the same place, but he gets there in a very different route, this first pope from the poor world. Take gay marriage. He opposes gay marriage, but he's in favour of civil unions. That's a human rights issue, he says. And yet he disapproves of gay adoption because he says gay adoption puts the right of parents to have children before the rights of children to have a mother and a father, and he thinks that's the wrong way around. So a nuanced and complicated thinker. But with it all, mercy is the gospel value which is higher than judgment or condemnation. So in other words, Pope Francis, a man of complexity in whom tradition and modernity are married in new ways. He's liberal in many actions, conservative in many statements, and that represents a challenge to both sides in the old polarization. So to one side he's saying, you must change your hearts. And to the other side he's saying, you must change your minds. And what I want to do today is to look at five key areas which I look at in my new book. It's an extensive revision and expansion of the instant book that I wrote after the Pope was elected, Pope Francis Untying the Knots. And what it's done is look at five particular areas where the Pope has done something interesting. And so they are the Vatican Bank, secondly, the Roman Curia, the bureaucracy, third, the sex abuse scandal, fourth, the church's attitude to women, and fifth, the battle lines which are increasingly being drawn and hardening between Francis and the conservatives over the synod, and there's even talk amongst some factions of a schism which could split apart the Catholic Church. And the new book has behind-the-scenes stories on all of those areas which cast interesting light on the kind of paradox of this Pope. So first, the Vatican Bank, and I start with that because that has been Pope Francis's most unequivocal success story. Scandals dogged the Vatican Bank since it was set up. It was only set up at the height of the Second World War to try and protect Vatican assets from the Nazis and then from the Russians. And by 1950, people were saying that there was over a quarter of a billion dollars worth of stolen Nazi gold in the Vatican Bank. Then in the 70s, more scandal. The head of the bank was an archbishop from America called Paul Marcinkus, and he started doing business with Roberto Calvi, the president of the Bank of Banco Ambrosiano in Milan. And it turned out that Calvi wasn't just a banker, he had links with the Sicilian mafia. And in 1982, this bank, the Banco Ambrosiano, dramatically collapsed, leaving 1.3 million black hole in its accounts. And it turned out that nearly half of this money had been borrowed by Calvi from 120 different banks around the world in the name of the Vatican Bank. And though the Vatican said, well, we didn't know anything about this, they ended up paying a quarter of $1 billion to creditors. And Marcinkus, there was a warrant issued for his arrest, which was never executed because he hid in the Vatican, which is a sovereign state. Now, the scandal of all this stuff about the Vatican Bank came as a severe shock to Catholics around the world, and it did immeasurable damage to the moral authority of the Church. There wasn't just financial skullduggery, there were political elements too. The job of the bank is to send money from Rome, from religious orders, from charities, out to the developing world, places that they don't have effective banking systems, to pay clergy, build schools and clinics and hospitals. But in the 1980s, Pope John Paul II used it to send money to Solidarity, the Polish trade union, which played a key role in triggering the fall of communism in Eastern Europe. And the CIA were involved, and there were suspicions that the bank was also used to fund the Contras in Nicaragua and other anti-communist guerrillas. Most recently, the scandal had been that it was implicated, the bank, in laundering mafia drug money, and also it was used by rich Italians for tax dodging. So when it came to electing a new pope, Pope Benedict had been aware of this, but he didn't really know or have the background in administrative skills to know how to tackle all of this effectively. But the cardinals knew when they were electing a new pope that this was something that was high on the list of things that needed to be done. And they elected Jorge Mario Bergoglio because when he was the Archbishop of Buenos Aires, amongst other things, he had tackled a lot of financial malpractice in the church involving a collapsing bank in a very similar situation. So as Pope, Francis got onto the Vatican Bank right away. He demanded new levels of accountability. He imposed a recruiting freeze. He stripped the cardinals who were in charge of it of their 25,000 a year euro stipend. And he brought in no fewer than five top level management consultants from around the world to scrutinize the bank and all the financial operations of the Vatican. And he set up an external commission of outsiders, secular financial legal experts to work out what should be done with the bank. And they also set up a second group of outside financiers to comb through the rest of the Vatican's portfolio and decide how it should be addressed. And the two groups are told, think the unthinkable, and that included shutting down the Vatican Bank if necessary. Now, it wasn't closed down because, as I indicated, it does have important and legitimate functions. But big, big change was in the air, and everyone knew that. And I discovered how big when I received an email from the bank one day, and they'd heard I was working on the second edition of my book, and they said they wanted to invite me in to what had been for generations one of the world's most secretive institutions and talk me through the reform process. It was a shock, to say the least. It came from the bank's press officer. The bank had never had a press officer. And what I found when I got in there was a team of 25 regulatory specialists had been flown in from New York, and over 6 months they'd trawled through 19,000 accounts, or more than that, 19,000 people had accounts in the Vatican Bank, and they'd cross-checked computer scans of the passport of every account holder against the records of the bank, and they established an IT system which ran an algorithm through every single transaction that had happened in recent years in that bank to see if they fitted an unusual pattern. And what they uncovered was poor cash flow checks, inadequate documentation, ignorance about due diligence procedures, and a complex system of proxies which clouded who really controlled these accounts. And when the senior bank officials were asked amid all this chaos how they answered to the regulator, they said, oh, we only answer to God. To which they were told, well, now you're going to answer to more earthly authorities. And at the end of this 6 months, 3,300 of these accounts were shut down. The team found 200 serious irregularities, which were reported to the bank's regulator, who passed the information on to the police and foreign banking authorities. And whenever any of the old guard put up resistance to any of these reforms, Pope Francis just removed them from office. And the most dramatic example of that was in June last year, when in one swoop he removed all five cardinals who were on the supervisory board and replaced them. Now, the old guard didn't take these changes lying down. Early on, the Pope put an old friend of his, Monsignor Battista Rica, inside the bank to be his eyes and ears. Enrique was given authority to access all documents and began to get very assertive. And dark forces within the Curia leaked a story about him to the Italian press. It claimed that he'd had homosexual affairs when he'd been a papal diplomat in Uruguay 10 years earlier. And one headline announced, "Catholic bishop in charge of cleaning up Vatican finances stuck in lift with rent boy." The Vatican denied the claims, but it was widely assumed that Rica would have to resign. However, Pope Francis was not so easily to be manipulated. He saw these leaks to the media as an attempt to undermine his Vatican Bank reform program. And when Rica went to the Pope and said, "I think I better resign," the Pope refused to accept his resignation. And when the press asked the Pope about all this, that was when he came out with the line that was perhaps the most totemic phrase of his papacy so far. "If a person is gay and seeks the Lord and has goodwill, who am I to judge?" So Francis's opponents would do well to note that he doesn't buckle in the face of opposition. This brings me to the second of our key areas, the reform of the Vatican bureaucracy. Every year, a couple of days before Christmas, the Pope traditionally assembles all the key people in the Roman Curia and delivers a kind of state of the church speech, which reviews the past year and looks ahead to the 12 months challenges. And it's the preamble to the Vatican top people's Christmas party. Well, normally it is, but last year it wasn't. Because last Christmas, Pope Francis set aside the traditional festive pleasantries, and in an uncompromising address, he berated his audience with a list of no fewer than 15 spiritual illnesses and temptations which he'd encountered in the Vatican in his first 2 years as Pope. And it was a really extraordinary broadside. It accused the churchmen before him of an exaggerated sense of self-importance, lust for power and control, lack of empathy for others, opposition to the movements of the Holy Spirit, careerism, calumny, defamation, discrediting others through leaks to the media, the terrorism of gossip, the perils of what he called spiritual Alzheimer's, ever the chap for a vivid phrase, and the serious evil of leading a double life, which he labelled existential schizophrenia. And these officials in their black robes with their purple sashes and their violet skullcaps sat unsmiling and listened to this for 30 minutes. It was not their idea of how the annual Christmas party should begin. Now, there are four ways to change an organisation. You can shift the people in the top jobs. You can bring in new people. You can make the people in the existing jobs start to behave differently. And you can change the structures of the organisation to promote different behaviour. And Francis has set about doing all of that. And I haven't got time to go into that, but the detail is all in the book. But he did something else, which is more subtle. From his very first minutes in office, Pope Francis had changed the culture of the institutional church. That moment on the balcony when he came out, and before he gave the blessing, he bowed his head and asked the people to bless the Pope. That was something which was setting out a different model of leadership. It took him just 1 month to make his first revolutionary change. And he set up a council of eight, later nine cardinals, the C9, we call it now, to help him in the government of the universal church, but also to draw up a comprehensive reform program for the Curia so it would cease to be the master of the church and become its servant instead. And he instructed this new council of cardinals to suggest more collegial ways in which the church could make decisions so that it reflected more the needs and the views of the church of the poor and the peripheries. The conservatives were horrified. One called the C9 a step towards the demolition of the papacy, replacing divinely instituted authority, hierarchy and stability with a quicksand swamp of collegiality. By contrast, one prominent liberal called it the most important step in the history of the church for the past 10 centuries. Seems to have forgotten about the Reformation, but we'll pass over that. Francis then began a clear out of the personnel. And the Catholic Herald, quite a traditional paper in this country, ran a headline, "Is Pope Francis purging the curia of conservatives?" And others spoke of de-ratzingerization. Among the first to go was, in the first 6 months, was Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone, who had been so powerful under Benedict that he'd been called a deputy pope. And half the members of the body which appoints bishops around the world were axed, including the American arch-conservative Cardinal Raymond Burke. And the pope replaced conservative ideologues on that body with orthodox, moderates, but people who shared his pastoral approach. Burke reacted by saying that under Francis the church was like a ship without a rudder and that it had lost its compass. Francis responded by sacking Burke from his job as the head of the Vatican Supreme Court. And it wasn't just Burke, dozens of curia officials from cardinals to lowly monsignors have been dispatched back to their home countries, having been politely thanked for their years of service. But Francis is actually more of a centrist than many liberals realise. He doesn't want to take the church to the left. He wants to take the church back to the middle. So he's not purged all the conservatives. He's embraced other hardliners like the German cardinal Gerhard Müller, who he's left in post as the head of the church's doctrine watchdog, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. Now, Müller is a conservative, but unlike Burke, he's a team player, and he's surprisingly sympathetic to the Latin American church's liberation theology tradition, which Francis has increasingly embraced over the years. Another conservative heavyweight, the Australian cardinal, George Pell, has been promoted to be the third most powerful figure in the Vatican as its finance supremo, but he's restricted to finance rather than talking on more general subjects. And one Vatican prelate, very delicately rephrasing a well-known expression to me, said, "Better to have him inside the tent shouting out than outside the tent shouting in." So Francis wants to include the whole political spectrum within the church in his team as long as they are team players and they pull together. And this is in contrast to previous popes who largely promoted men in their own conservative image. And those men, particularly in the United States, are the people who've ramped up what the Americans call the culture wars, which have elevated conversations around abortion and homosexuality into kind of badges of Catholic identity. Are you a Catholic or not? Then you have to believe this. But Francis has been much more subtle than might be suggested by saying who's been moved in and who's been moved out, because he shifted the balance of power within the Vatican as well. The office of the Secretary of State, once occupied by Bertone, the Benedict's deputy pope, has been stripped of its financial powers, and those have been moved over to Pell's economic department. And the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, where Ratzinger served for many, many years, which used to be known in Rome as La Suprema, is supreme no more. Francis privately told religious orders in Latin America, and it was amazingly leaked immediately, that they shouldn't worry if they got a disciplinary letter from the CDF, because just carry on with your good work. And he's given the nod to his cardinal advisors to publicly criticise the prefect of the CDF if they think that he said something that is wrong. So this is a real significant shift. And the biggest shift has been in the appointment of cardinals. He's appointed 39, and the people who got these red hats are not all from the same point on the liberal conservative spectrum, but they are all pastors rather than culture war ideologues. And what's most striking about it is the geographical spread. Only a few of them are from Europe, none are from the United States, and those are the two areas which are overrepresented in the College of Cardinals if you compare it with a map of where most Catholics live around the world. And significant numbers of these new cardinals are from the poorest countries in the world. Burkina Faso, Ethiopia, Haiti, Nicaragua, the Ivory Coast, Tonga, Vietnam, really places that were not part of the church map in the past as far as the College of Cardinals were concerned. So the result is that for the first time in church history, Europe now has fewer cardinals than the rest of the world. First time that's happened. And whereas before, only 35% of cardinals were from the developing world, now 41% are. And the significance of this is, these are the people who will elect the new pope, the next pope. And what Francis has done here could constitute the orchestration of a really major shift which would change Catholicism forever. Change on this curial front is very complicated, much more complicated than with the Vatican Bank, so it's not as advanced as in the case of the bank, but it could, in the end, prove to be more far-reaching. So I want to turn now to the third of my areas, which is the sex abuse crisis, which has so deeply shamed the Catholic Church in the closing decades of the 20th century. Now, progress here has been much more slow and much more patchy. And this is because what I've discovered is there is a hidden civil war going on inside the Vatican over this. One side in this civil war wants openness, wants abusers held to account, and wants the bishops who've covered up for the abusers held to account. And the other, as the book shows in great detail, the other side is surreptitiously doing everything it can to undermine the reform agenda, and this opposition comes at the very highest levels. And there's another problem, and that is that there's an ambivalence at the heart of Francis on this issue himself, which I'll explain. Now, it took the Pope a full year to get round to even beginning to address the sex abuse question. One of the Pope's cardinal advisors, Sean O'Malley from Boston, had spent a decade trying to clear up hundreds of sex abuse cases in Boston. And he raised it at the first meeting of the C9 now, and said, we've got to deal with this. But the other cardinals and the Pope didn't see it as a priority. O'Malley wasn't to be moved, and he badgered the Pope for 10 months. And eventually, Francis took him aside and said to him, OK, what do we need to do? The very next day, O'Malley went out, called a press conference, and announced that the Pope was setting up a pontifical commission for the protection of minors. The Vatican was taken completely unawares. The usual protocol with these things is to consult within the Curia about this new body, and then there would be turf wars within the Curia about who would control it, and various factions would have their say on who should be the members and what its remit should be. And only when all that had been sorted out, and that always takes years, if not decades, only then is the thing announced. O'Malley turned all that completely upside down. He announced it first. And then he said to the media, oh, well, the specifics will be worked out later. But the members will be experts in the work of safeguarding children. And they would include people who had practical experience of taking care of children. So the commission would therefore include outsiders, horror of horrors. And these people would report directly to the Pope. The people who were opposed to this began foot dragging immediately, and so it was 5 months before the commission even met. And when it did, O'Malley made a startling confession to other members of the commission. He said, In spite of this having the backing of Pope Francis, it's run into such serious opposition. The whole enterprise from a group of officials within the Curia. And he said, only the finance reforms have experienced stiffer resistance than this. And the opponents were arguing a variety of things. They were saying that, oh, a public commission will only damage the reputation of the church. Others argued, this is a particularly good one, that it wasn't a real universal problem, it was an Irish problem. It was only found in countries where Irish priests had gone, like England and the United States and Australia. Of course, the evidence is that it's there in every country, and the evidence of that is pouring into the commission now. Others said, it's just a historical problem. Now we've got better controls on the selection of candidates for the priesthood. This won't happen again. Yet, although these people in the Curia had all these arguments about why the commission wasn't a good idea, they then became desperate to control it. And early on, members of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith tried to bring the commission under their jurisdiction, and then officials from the Secretariat of State began to make moves. At the end of their first meeting, the outside commissioners got their first direct glimpse of how the unseen forces in the Vatican work and how they intrigue to steer events to their own opaque ends. The commission secretary left the room with a press release that they'd agreed, and they all thought he was going to get it published. And half an hour later, he came back and said, the Secretary of State has been helping us translate this, and he has a few concerns about a few words. And one of the members of the commission said to me, I thought it was amazing that they thought we would be so naive as to believe there was no one in the Vatican who could translate something from English to Italian without it being the Secretary of State personally. And the changes that the Secretary of State wanted to make made, according to my source, made everything a little more woolly. So the commissioners were beginning to learn how the Vatican works. Everyone in the Vatican is afraid of plain language, the commissioner said. And I've got some other great examples of that in the book. And after their second meeting, the same thing happened. They drew up a press release, they agreed it went out. When it was published the next day, some bits had mysteriously disappeared. And this intrigue continued. The commission discussed where they should site their office. Some of them said, oh, well, let's have it in the Vatican. And then the bishops will realise that it's close to the seat of power and they'll have to take notice of it. Others said, no, we want the outside world to be able to access what we're doing and we need to contact people, they need to contact us. Let's have it outside the Vatican. And so they agreed it will be outside of the Vatican. 2 weeks before their third meeting, they got an email saying, oh, the new office, which is inside the Vatican, is actually inside the Secretary of State's office. And when they got to the meeting, which was there to draw up the constitution and the remit of the commission, they found someone had helpfully done it for them already. The lay members staged a revolt and said, no, we're not going to have your constitution, we'll draw up our own. But one of them said to me afterwards, there's an influential camp who are doing their best to block change on this and on a range of other issues on which Pope Francis wants movement. Some of these people have absolutely no scruples about getting their own way. What adds a complication is that there is Pope Francis himself, his track record on abuse when he was Archbishop of Buenos Aires was ambiguous. One survivor group, SNAP, in the United States, said that when he was Archbishop, he had a record of rebuffing people, victims and their families, who approached him for help. One of his closest aides in Buenos Aires, who I saw a lot of, said, no, that's not fair, because most of those cases weren't within his archdiocese, so he didn't have authority to deal with things that were happening in other dioceses. But there is one case which offers a very interesting clue to Francis's thinking on all this. The most infamous child abuser in Argentina, when Bergoglio was an archbishop, he eventually got 15 years jail for what he was doing, was defended by Francis for 6 years, the first 6 years of his trials. He went to three different trials, to the Supreme Court, and the church backed him all the way. Francis felt that this man was being unfairly accused, and he still fears that the new mood on the way that people look at sex abuse is open to false accusations against priests. And this explains why, when you look at his track record over the past 2 years, he's taken firm action, belatedly in some cases, but he's taken firm action against some bishops, but other bishops who have been accused of cover-ups, he's kept in office to the alarm of members of his own commission. And the Pope, they fear, doesn't understand the implications of the zero-tolerance approach on abuse, which he's actually endorsed for the Church. So that is an interesting and complicated area. Which brings us to the fourth, the one in which, in my view, the Pope has made least progress, and that's the role of women in the Church. In his very first interview as Pope, Francis announced, "We have to work harder to develop a profound theology of women. Only by making this step will it be possible to better reflect on their function within the Church. The feminine genius is needed wherever we make important decisions." Now, this sounded promising, and Francis washed the feet of women, which popes had never done before, and he brought to an abrupt end an investigation which had lasted 7 years into US nuns, which had been launched by Vatican conservatives. But for all that, and for all his sympathetic noises, he hasn't actually done an awful lot in practical terms. Asked about women priests, he said, oh no, the church has spoken on that, that door is closed. So what about women cardinals? Because you don't have to be technically a priest to be a cardinal. Well, no, we've got too many cardinals and we don't want any more clericalisation. Well, what about women as heads of Vatican departments? No, you have to be a cardinal to be a head of... So what can women do in the church apart from make the coffee and arrange the flowers? The Pope's reply was opaque. Women in the church are more important than bishops and priests. How, he said, this is something we have to try to explain better, because I believe we lack a theological explanation of this. But then he retreated into the traditional church position, saying, we must not confuse function with dignity. Women and men are equal in dignity, but have different roles to play, a distinction which many other churches have called into question. So one thing the Pope did do in this direction was he appointed a number of women to the top theological advisory body in the Vatican. There had been two. He increased that to 5. There's still 25 men, but 5 women now. And he said, well, more women will be appointed. But then he overshadowed this small step forward by describing the women he'd appointed as the strawberries on the cake. As though he thought women were nothing but sweet and decorative. And one celebrated female theologian reposted, if the women are the strawberries, then the men are the nuts. So what does this boil down to? I think Francis is an elderly man from a traditional Latin American macho culture. He has got first-hand experience of working with professional women. His first boss, who he really held in high esteem when he worked in a chemistry laboratory, was a woman. And his close friend throughout the dirty war in Argentina was a female human rights lawyer. But he's not exactly up to speed on gender theory. And his dominant template for women in the church are his grandmother and his mother. Women, aren't they lovely? And he says things like, women should emulate Mary in being motherly, gentle and tender. Well, that's fine, but it's not quite enough. One person who said that to him was a woman called Ulla Gudmundsson. She's a very rare creature, a female ambassador to the Holy See. She represented Sweden. And through a high-up intermediary, she got a message to the Pope suggesting that his attitude to women was patronising. And when the Pope said Mary was more important than popes, bishops and priests, she said, that sounds like an alibi for not making any room in the church for living women. And at the end of last year, when she was leaving her job as ambassador, she had a farewell audience with the Pope. And she handed him a list with the names, emails and phone numbers of 50 Catholic women theologians. If we need a new theology of women, she suggested, you should look at the writing of women theologians who've been doing the theology of women for 50 years. Women are the best, are your best allies when it comes to social justice, she told him. In the end, when it comes to women, Pope Francis is clearly aware that the church has a problem, but he doesn't seem to have any idea at all about what the solution should be. And so, to the last of our 5 areas. And in many ways, this is the most radical area in which the Pope is acting. And this is what is setting the battle lines between Francis and the conservatives and the traditionalists, some of whom have begun to talk about schism even, and what is clearly becoming a struggle for the soul of Catholicism, which is the title I've taken for this book. Perhaps the most revolutionary change Pope Francis wants is in the way the Catholic Church makes its decisions. His aim is to replace a monarchical model of papacy with something more collegial and consultative. He wants the Church, as I said, to become a servant rather than a master. He wants the Vatican to become a servant rather than a master to the Church. And to that end, he's trying to elevate the status of the Synod of Bishops. And when the Synod met last October to discuss the family, Francis instructed bishops to speak boldly rather than saying what they thought it was the Pope wanted to hear. Robust, openness was better than what he called a false and quietist peace. And earlier, he'd asked Cardinal Walter Kasper, a well-known progressive, to kickstart this discussion amongst the cardinals. And Kasper, who's for years advocated a more inclusive attitude to gays and a lifting of the ban of the church on remarried Catholics taking communion, warned the Pope. He said, "Well, if you choose me, you know, there will, with his exact words, a Holy Father, there will be a controversy." And the Pope just laughed and replied, "Good, we should have that." So the synod debate was the most open, passionate, and controversial for half a century. It wasn't a rubber stamping job as in the past. And disagreement is no longer branded as dissent. The Pope said it's healthy to get things out into the open. Now, if you think about it, what was distinctive, part of what was distinctive about that defining phrase of the Pope, "Who am I to judge?" was that it was a question rather than a statement. And after decades of popes who wanted to make assertions, Francis is a Pope who wants the church to start asking questions. The conservatives have been rattled by this on two levels. First, they don't like this pastoral openness towards the divorced and gays. And Cardinal Burke even compared gay couples and remarried Catholics to murderers. But secondly, the conservatives see the debate within the synod, or any debate, as a threat to the authority and stability of the church and its teaching. So clerics who had felt smiled upon in the Benedict years, now felt pushed to the curb. And suddenly they felt like the elder brother in the parable of the prodigal son. In the months before the synod, you know, Francis had killed the fatted calf for the prodigal sons and daughters of the postmodern world and reached out to gays and women, the divorced, prisoners, the poor, non-believers, atheists, and virtually every other constituency inside and out the church that had felt alienated in the past. And there are an awful lot of those prodigals one way or another, which is partly why the Pope is so popular. But there are a lot of elder brothers too. And many of them are these bishops from the John Paul Benedict era who were men in the mould of the popes who'd elevated them. And they were grumbling as the elder son grumbles in the parable. Francis seems unfazed by this. He said in an interview recently, "Resistance is now more evident, but that's a good sign for me. It's out in the open. I'm not worried. If there were no difference of opinion, that wouldn't be normal." Few in the Catholic Church see schism as a real possibility. Catholics have always seen schism as a rather Protestant activity, I'm afraid. Conservative bishops in the Catholic Church know there's a huge amount of infrastructure, ecclesiologically, architecturally, financially, to create and to pay for. The one US commentator, David Gibson, rather tartly put it, for Catholics, it's not like being a zealous Baptist who can start a new congregation with a Bible, a river, and maybe a tent. But the talk of schism is important because it's a kind of emotional release valve for which it reveals how unsettled the conservatives are by Francis. Most of Francis' opponents are not as bold as Burke, who's now lost so many jobs that he's got nothing else to lose, he clearly feels. But the other conservatives have adopted a kind of very thinly disguised code, and the code word they prefer is confusion. The Pope is confusing. The faithful are confused. And what, of course, they mean by confusion is the Pope is saying things we don't agree with. And the leaders of this faction are most particularly in the United States. The Archbishop Chaput from Philadelphia is the leader. The Cardinal George from Chicago died recently. He was a prominent figure. Chaput, who within a few months of Francis's installation was cautioning that what Chaput openly called the right wing of the church generally had, as he put it, not been very happy about this election. And after the synod, Chaput went further. He said, "Confusion is of the devil, and the public image that came across of the synod was one of confusion." Chaput, you must remember, is the man who's hosting Pope Francis on his visit to the United States next month. The world meeting of families is in Philadelphia, and that's the prime reason for the Pope going there. Chaput said recently, conflict always does two things. It purifies the church and it clarifies the character of the enemies who hate her. Now, this is fighting talk. And had a liberal said anything like that about Pope John Paul II or Pope Benedict, he would have been hauled to Rome for a severe dressing down. But Francis seems to be playing a longer game, and he's happy to let that ride. The Pope has two impulses here. On the substantive issue, this creating a more welcoming church for the remarried and for gays, it's clear he wants change. I've spoken to several individuals who've been summoned to talk privately to him, and they've confirmed to me that's what he thinks. But there's also this process issue, wanting the church to change the way it makes decisions. And Francis feels, I think, more strongly about that. And his strength of feeling stems from the lessons he learned after his time as provincial leader of the Jesuits in Argentina, where he was given authority at too young an age. And he confessed in his first interview as Pope that he'd been too authoritarian and had come across as an ultra-conservative and had made hundreds of errors. And as a result of that, the Jesuits sent him into exile in Cordoba for 2 years, where he experienced what he called a great interior crisis. And there's an extra chapter on what happened there on that in my book. But he emerged from this experience, this exile in Cordoba, as a changed man. He had swapped this authoritarian style for a readiness to listen and to consult. And now he wants the church to do the same thing. And understanding that is central to understanding how he's handling the synod process, which provoked such passionate controversy last October, and now looks set to do the same this October in Rome. For this second synod in Rome, Francis is sending ambiguous signals. If he's forced to choose between these two outcomes, lifting the ban on remarried communion and giving free rein to a more participative process, I suspect he might go for the latter, because he wants above all to change the way the church makes its decisions. But those close to Francis think that he can achieve both. His opponents think that he is trying to load the process. He's chosen the same team to run the 2015 synod as run the last one. And he's blocked Cardinal Burke as a dialogue. And he's chosen, and he's allowed to handpick a third of the delegates. The rest are chosen by bishops' conferences around the world. He's chosen people like Cardinal Casper, Cardinal Daniels, Archbishop Supich from Chicago, people who share his own reconciliatory view on the treatment of the remarried and gays. And some even think that when the synod is over, the Pope may well announce a lifting of the ban, whatever the synod concludes, and he'll just use the things that people say in the synod in his support to do that. Who knows? But his nephew said in a recent interview, the Holy Spirit is working in him. He was a very dour man, very serious, dutiful man when he was in Buenos Aires. Now he is this warm, happy, avuncular character. I see him rejuvenated, his nephew says, easygoing, free, happy in the things he's taking forward. Being Pope seems to have liberated him to be the person that he feels God meant him to be. One of his oldest friends told me, as a concluding remark, he's having fun with all the people in the Vatican telling him he can't do things and then doing them. Things are going to get a lot more interesting yet, I suspect. Thank you. Time for questions, so don't be shy because we haven't got that much time. Sir?
Oh, yes. The microphone, please.
Ah, it's a microphone on this way. Right.
Can you just pass it over?
Oh, hi. Yes. In the Catholic Church, the The rule of law is what the Pope says it is. Fair enough, the Pope is now going to make some changes. It sounds good. But say he retires or passes over, you could have another Pope who brings the whole thing back into conservatism again. One thing I'm disappointed in is there's not going to be any likelihood in the foreseeable future of women priests, let alone women bishops, which I had hoped that would be the case. And, that is my concern, the fact there's no parliament in the Catholic Church. Another point is it'd be good if the idea of celibate priesthood was finished. I think it would help the abuse problem if you had married priests, let alone women priests. The Catholic Church needs booting into the 21st century, because at the moment it's stuck in a very, very deep rut. I welcome your comments, please.
I don't think that's a question. I mean, I think it speaks for itself. Let's try, lady here.
So I know that, for example, the LGBT community, but also Tina Beattie is writing a book for female voices, academic voices, from the hopefully the whole Catholic spectrum, that. These books and ideas are being taken to synod. And I'm wondering how much mileage you think there is in trying to bring the voice of the everyday layperson to the synod.
To comment on what you said, I mean, it is a statement, not a question. But I agree with you is that the Catholic Church is starting from a much lower base in terms of democratization. However, the amounts of change that are happening within it, given the narrowness of that starting place, are, I think, quite significant. And when you talk about ordinary people being involved. One of the things that this Pope did, one of the first things he did for this synod was to say, let's have a questionnaire of ordinary people. Now, the Vatican officials tried to undermine that by making it utterly opaque and difficult to understand and addressed to theologians or whatever. But he wanted to know what ordinary people thought. And a lot of ordinary people ignored the questions and just wrote down what they thought. And this is in contrast to when there was a thing called the National Pastoral Congress in 1980, I think it was, in this country, in Liverpool. Archbishop Warlock and Cardinal Hume and it was a meeting of about 2,000 ordinary people. There were priests and bishops there, but a lot of them were laity. They took the results of that to Rome, gave it to Pope John Paul, and said, it's a big document, but just read this page. And he looked at it, shut it, gave it to somebody else, and he said, in effect, we're not interested in what the laity think. So by having a questionnaire, he's signalling a huge change. And it may be an oil tanker, which will take a long time to turn around. But I don't think you should underestimate the significance of things like that.
Yeah. I speak as a Catholic who's taken a lot of flack, both in the parish and in prayer groups I'm involved in, from ultra-conservatives, largely because of my stance on justice and peace issues. When I look behind these attacks, all the threads seem to lead to Opus Dei. Can you tell me what the Pope's stance is on that particular organisation? Secondly, the rumour is going around all the time that he's about to make a final pronouncement on the authenticity or non-authenticity of the apparitions at Medjugorje. Can you tell us anything about that, whether that's likely to happen?
As far as I understand it, the Pope is not particularly enthused by Medjugorje, so I'd be surprised if that was the case. On Opus Dei, he's had ambiguous relationships with people from Opus Dei. A lot of the hardline conservatives in Latin America who took lines against the positions he would adopt were Opus Dei, but there are other people in Opus Dei. Opus Dei is a much more complicated organisation than is often portrayed in the media. And it has good points. It has a focus on the laity and so forth. But it's got a secretive side and it's got a conservative side. It's different. Opus Dei is different in different countries. It's a very complicated question, and you'd need to talk to somebody who's written a book about Opus Dei, really. But I know that Francis is not particularly keen on them, and he's not particularly against them.
phrase the question, or basically the statement the first question person, basically the first man made, phrase it into a question, which is how sustainable are the changes the Pope is making at the moment if he retires or dies? I mean, you mentioned the cardinals. He kind of tries to set up who will elect the next Pope. But, yeah, how sustainable is that change?
That's a good question, and I don't pretend to know the answer to it, but there is some interesting thoughts on it. Yes, of course, the papacy is a monarchy, and if a new king comes in, it could all change like that. However, it's also very respectful of its own traditions, and the fact that we have now had a pope who said things like this pope has said, as pope, will always be a factor. There's a theologian Metz, I think it is, talks about dangerous memory. Francis will always be a dangerous memory in the papacy, even if he's replaced by Benedict XVII and it all goes back to where it was. But I think the changes he's making and the example he's giving, and a lot of these American conservatives are not ideological, they're kind of pastoral conservatives, and they're very open-minded about the Pope, and they... It doesn't seem to me to be a foregone conclusion that the next conclave would elect somebody who went back. I think it's a kind of, you know, thesis-antithesis thing. You might end up with somebody in the middle. And somebody like Cardinal Tagle from the Philippines, who would have been a candidate this time, but he was outrageously young. He was about 60, which is very young. You know? There's hope for me yet. So I think you could find the church could tack and it could go more back towards the right, but it wouldn't go back as far to the right. And I'm optimistic.
Paul.
Yeah.
This way.
Over here. To your left.
Right. Thank you.
I'm a female lesbian Protestant minister from Australia.
Right.
And I really like this Pope. I've never taken a lot of interest in the past because they all seem to reflect the conservatism that a lot of Catholic people rallied against, particularly some of the nuns that I know well. One thing bothers me about this Pope, and that is I'm not exactly sure how he gets around publicly, but there are a lot of photos and illustrations of him driving his Fiat. How safe is he? Is he likely? Because, you know, when I say in passing conversation, until he's assassinated, because he's doing such radical things that are getting up the noses of the Conservatives, how safe is he?
Well, I mean, he's not safe in one sense, and I certainly wouldn't want him behind the wheel of a car, I don't think so. He goes to these dangerous places and he won't wear a bulletproof vest. He won't have bulletproof glass in his Pope mobile. He says, you know, when the Lord calls me, that's fair enough. So he's not safe in that way at all. His health seems quite good. He's 78. He's got sciatica, but he's very sprightly. And he's clearly been rejuvenated by being made Pope. I don't think there's an immediate prospect of him conking out. And he's been very clever to say that he is open to the idea of resigning, but he's certainly not going to resign when he's 80, so don't get the impression that we've just got 2 years of lame duck pope, as it were. He's a very sophisticated, shrewd operator, as well as a man of kind of iconic simplicity.
Yeah. Following on a little bit from that question, one of my Roman Catholic charismatic friends thinks that the danger of assassination will be from within the curia rather than from outside.
Well,
what comment do you have on that?
You should ask David Yallop about that. I'm not that kind of conspiracy theorist. I think people work in confluences together and in confluences of interest. I don't think that kind of conspiracy stuff is... Archbishop Wieselowski was to be the first man put on trial for sex abuse in the Vatican. He was hauled back from the Dominican Republic to face trial. He died yesterday, you know, just before he could face trial. Oh, oh, oh. You know, I think he was ill, you know. I don't think there's any chance that the Pope will be bumped off from within the Curia. But one of his friends did say to me, we said to him, remember, the Borgias are still active, Jorge. And he said, that's why I eat in the canteen.
Paul, thank you very much. On behalf of Greenbelt, thank you.